Are you gonna go see my parents, Kate, while you're out there?
Yeah, you didn't know? We're going to dinner tonight.
They didn't text me.
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
Oh, see, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Madeline, an editor at 538, and with me on the other line, I'm all alone in the studio today, is ESPN W columnist and our senior mountaineering advisor, Kate Fagan. Mm. Kate, you're out there in the great Mountain West.
I am. I'm sitting right now in Boulder, Colorado, in the CU campus, looking out at the Flatiron. So that was the most appropriate title that I have this week. I'm going to live up to it.
Did they receive you with a hero's welcome at your alma mater?
If there's a couple people who give you a high five, is that a hero's welcome?
It's like an old pal around the neighborhood.
Yes.
Excellent. So on today's show, Neil Payne is still out, still on vacation, so he claims. Such a slacker, that stat man Payne. So on today's show, we're gonna have a caravan of guests. First, we're gonna talk about athlete activism with New York Magazine's Reeves Wideman, who wrote a recent piece on Colin Kaepernick and other star athletes who are speaking out more about politics than athletes were a decade or so ago. And we'll talk about whether it's new and why it's happening and what it may mean. I believe that maybe 538 Politics podcast gabber Harry Enten may even stop by to talk about some polling. And then after that, we will talk about Claudio Ranieri, who is out at Leicester City after winning the English Premier League last season. Why was he sacked, as the Brits like to say, and does it even matter? We'll talk with Michael Cayley about that. Michael Cayley from the Double Pivot Pod. And then we'll have Sam Miller, ESPN's baseball writer Sam Miller, on to discuss his recent piece about who the best player in the majors would be in a world without stats. So if you had no stats whatsoever, who would you think the best baseball player in the league would be? Kate, do you have your answer already?
Yeah. I mean, I'm assuming one of the factors is like has to be a New York Met.
I love it. I mean, certainly between you and me, those are the factors, yeah. Save for the segment.
Okay.
And then that's it. And then Sig Dig, and we're out. One quick announcement. Our show at the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference is coming up this Friday. Thank you to those who left those reviews in iTunes to bribe us into getting you some passes to Sloan. Those of you who have won those passes have been alerted. A few of you will be joining us, which I'm very excited to meet you guys in Boston on Friday. From a programming standpoint, that means that the podcast you'll get in your feeds, listeners, next Tuesday will be that live Sloan show, and we'll try and make some evergreen stuff that stands up from Friday to Tuesday. And we don't have any T-shirts this year, Kate. Remember last time we had T-shirts to give out to people?
Why don't we have T-shirts? I still wear my T-shirt from last year.
No, we didn't have any gimmicks to put on a T-shirt. That's got to be a goal for 2017. The come next Sloan, we've got...
Be more gimmicky.
Yeah, I like that. That's good. All right, let's get on with the show. Okay, for our first segment, joining us today is Reeves Wideman, a contributing editor at New York Magazine. Reeves, welcome to Hot Takedown.
Thanks for having me.
Hot Takedown debut. We like to, you know, Chris and all.
It's all great to be here. I'm a little nervous, but hopefully it'll go okay.
It'll go fine. So Reeves, recently you wrote a piece in New York Magazine called As American as Refusing to Stand for the National Anthem. It's a piece about the recent wave of activism within professional athletics. And you talked to Colin Kaepernick. You sort of charted the rise of this after Trayvon Martin's killing in Florida and how LeBron James was involved. Where did you get the idea for the story, and you know, how did you go about reporting it out?
First, unfortunately, we didn't get to talk to Colin. He is kind of has decided to sort of lay low postseason. But we basically what we set out to try to do was to take stock of the sort of movement that he started, you know, where it's this obviously 6 months or so after he first took a knee. And we wanted to take a look at what were sort of the historical factors that kind of led up to this. His was sort of the biggest moment of athlete activism in decades, but it wasn't the only one in recent years. And then try to kind of figure out what was going on and figure out where things might go from here as we have members of the Patriots declining to go to the White House, apparently. Brands and advertisers apparently sort of catching up to athletes on this and just figuring out what might happen next.
And what was interesting, and Kate Hoppin in a second, what was interesting is there seemed to be almost professional fixers who are helping athletes become more engaged politically as they go through their careers and maybe take interest in things that are happening within their team's community or otherwise. I didn't know that those folks were out there. Do they seem like of a similar sort of role that an agent might play or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, similar roles exist in Hollywood and to different degrees. I mean, you'll get agents who kind of do it on the side. You know, they will proclaim that, you know, activism and getting involved in the community is part of what we do. This was more people who, they're coming from the other side. They're activists or people who are involved in politics who were suddenly like, wait, you know, these athletes can actually, like, A, are interested, and B, can sort of move the needle. So, you know, there were I talked to a number of people who worked in the Obama White House about basically how they tried to bring athletes into the fold and, like, getting them involved in specifically in, like, getting people enrolled in the ACA. And then sort of these kind of like political fixers who sort of up until now have kind of been doing it part-time, helping athletes get meetings on the Hill and things like that. And now there are a handful of people that I talk to who basically I would call an athlete, and they, you know, I talk, for instance, to Sean Doolittle, who's a pitcher for the A's, and he's been outspoken on refugees and other issues. And he was like, I had no idea what to do. It turned out his teammate, Jed Lowry's wife, used to work for the State Department. And she decided, along with another guy who used to work with the State Department, that there was this sort of need for helping athletes figure out, if I want to get involved, what's an organization that's trustworthy? How do I get a meeting with a congressman and things like that? And so those people are kind of starting to create jobs out of nothing.
I think one statement I always consistently hear is when people suggest that, you know, sports and politics now are mixing more. You often hear people say, mm-hmm. well, politics and sports have always been inextricably linked. And then we point to a number of, Pat, which yeah. I will do now, right? The Mexico City Olympics and Ali. After doing this story, do you feel like there truly was a time when maybe athletes were more political, and then the, you know, the ebb and flow of it went where it was devoid from the most part from athlete life, and now we're seeing an increase? Or is it simply that athletes always have been?
I think there's a couple things going on. One, the 60s were a moment of activism in the country for everyone. So in a certain way, athletes were kind of doing the same thing the rest of the country is, in a way that maybe we're going through something similar now. Carmelo at one point said, you know, he was like, this is the new 60s. And he was talking about having spoken with, you know, his sort of elders, people from the movement, about that. So I think in some ways that's just kind of the, you know, the 80s, 90s were not a huge moment for activism in general. At the same time, I think one thing that did happen is a lot of athletes were pushing for their own rights. They were pushing for free agency. They were pushing for better pay. And that was kind of the cause that at least a lot of athletes took up, at least the bigger names. You'll find a lot of smaller names. Like one famous story is Craig Hodges, who was a reserve guard for the Bulls in the 90s, won a couple championships. I talked to him. This didn't end up making it in the story, and he's told the story before, but he says he had been very active in sort of promoting you know, the supporting the African American community in Chicago. He tried to get Jordan and Magic to boycott Game One of the 1991 Finals. He says he walked up to him and like shoot around and tried to say, "Hey, this would be a big deal if I do it, Craig Hodges. No one's going to give a crud." And he, you know, he asked them. They obviously said no. Later that year, he went to the White House and gave a letter to then President Bush to try to get support. But then, you know, he obviously didn't make as much of an impact if Michael Jordan had even said something at the time. So I think the bigger name athletes sort of shied away from it. And then more recently, through a variety of factors, it sort of come back.
What, I guess when you say from a variety of factors, it'd be great to kind of understand what those variables are. I think one of them is, as you touched on, like, if there are actual people now, and I'm sure there were similar in the 60s who are in the business, whether it's monetary or not, of educating athletes. I mean, that's a huge hurdle to clear because nobody wants to speak on anything they don't – well, people do anyway, but most athletes will be like, I want to be well-versed in this, just like they're well-versed in sports and they speak on sports. And so maybe that's one variable, but like, what do you see as the other variables for – why this moment now?
Yeah, I think back in the 60s, like, there was a very tight connection, you know, like Tommy Smith and John Carlos, before they raised their fist at the Olympics, like, they were in touch with Martin Luther King. They had met with people in the movement. Like, there was a very tight connection between the athletes who were speaking out and your sort of everyday activists. And so I think that's one thing that happened now. And I think I sort of hate to give credit to social media, but I do think in this case, you now not only, I mean, the obvious thing is athletes can just say, you know, they can speak directly to fans. They don't have to go through reporters. But the other thing is that they are seeing this stuff, and particularly it obviously comes to play with issues of police shootings starting in 2012 with Trayvon Martin. The Miami Heat they're sitting there on their phones watching this stuff happen in a way that they might not have been reading the newspaper all the time. It was just kind of had become a part of the information they consumed.
Well, and what's interesting is in your piece, you note that I think LeBron, when he had gone back to Cleveland, did not know about the Tamir Rice shooting for a couple weeks after it had happened. Some reporter or somebody had asked him about it after reporters had stopped asking LeBron about his stance on issues of national importance because he wasn't going to comment. Then they asked him, he didn't know, and now some of these fixers are giving athletes news articles essentially to study up and figure out what they want to do on it. And so, you know, even with social media, it seems like there's an extra layer that's still happening. But maybe the idea of having a platform to say what they want to say without a team filter is part of it too.
Yeah, and I think most people would say, you know, LeBron sort of responded to this kind of specific thing. There was this whole campaign to get him to boycott a game, and he was like, you know, I just don't know. I just don't have enough information, which is like a very responsible answer for anyone to give to something that they don't know about. Obviously, by that point, it was kind of expected of him, so people were disappointed. But I think every athlete I talked to was like, in any locker room, as in society, there are guys who are smart, there are people who are kind of somewhere in the middle, and then there are guys who are not. And sometimes the guys who are not, or just don't care to stay informed, want to say something that's probably not good for anyone. So, you know, LeBron, for instance, now someone from his team told me, you know, he'll see something on Twitter. He wants to know more about it. He'll let them know, send them a couple of articles, and he'll try to read up. Because I think he now knows if something happens, I'm going to get asked about it.
I'm curious, after writing this article, how much you think getting into politics and social issues is really good for any athlete. If you're a superstar and you're impervious to you know, getting benched or that like talent versus distraction level, well, then it's obviously not a great move for you. Like a Craig Hodges, who I think even sued the NBA because he felt that he got blackballed from the league because of handing President Bush that letter. But for the like the big brand athletes, like, even so, does mainstream America who might not agree with their politics, like, does it ding their brand?
I think it can. I think one thing that has happened is for a lot of those guys, you know, I mean, the Steph Curry thing is like a perfect example from a few weeks ago where Under Armour's CEO comes out, expresses some level of support. Steph Curry comes out, disagrees, talks to the Under Armour CEO. They sort of walk it back a little bit. I think the power dynamic has changed a little bit to where I think there was a point, at least for the top tier guys, where they had to be careful because the endorsers would back away. It's almost like shocking. I think it would be impossible to imagine a major company backing off of a player for making a political statement now. I mean, there are obviously other reasons they would, but I think that has made it sort of a little more secure.
So I want to bring in 538's politics writer, Harry Enten, to give sort of some metrics and some stack grounding in this, not about the number of athletes who have spoken out or anything like that. I think, Reeves, in your piece, you mentioned it was like 50 of the 1,700 NFL players.
It's not that many.
Said something about followed Kaepernick's lead in some way. But Harry, welcome to the show, first of all.
Thanks for having me.
It's been so long since
I know, right?
And so, Harry, I tasked you with a chore before you came on, and Aaron even, which was to look into the polling around athletes being activists and what the general public thought about it. And you went into the various databases that you keep on the side, and what'd you
come
up with?
I keep them. They're in my house in a little lock and box. So there are two different questions that I essentially wanted to get at. Number one, the question about standing for the national anthem, and then the second, the broader question about athletes being involved with political causes. And interestingly, the two different questions lead to different findings. So if you were to look at, say, should the athletes in the NFL, should they be required to stand for the national anthem or not, a Marist poll from September of 2016 found that a majority of people said that, yes, the athletes should be required to stand for the national anthem. And that breaks down along perhaps the lines you might expect, where African Americans were less likely to believe that athletes should have to stand for the national anthem or not. White people were more likely to believe that. Democrats were less likely to believe, and Republicans were more likely to believe that the athletes should stand for the national anthem. On the second question, however, which is should athletes be involved with political causes, a majority of Americans agree that they should be allowed to be. In fact, they should be encouraged to. And again, it draws along the same exact lines, except everything's perhaps a little bit higher in terms of professional athletes being involved. 54% of Americans said that they should be. Among football fans, it was actually slightly higher at 57%. And a large portion of Democrats and African Americans and those with a college degree believe that athletes should be allowed to be involved in political campaigns, such as an endorsing a candidate or speaking out on a cause. So you have that split there.
So I you know, we haven't talked about race so far in this segment. It seems like we can't not, because the athletes who have spoken out are largely African American. At least those who chronicle.
The only, unless I've missed someone, the only prominent white athlete who took a knee or somehow made an individual stand was Megan Rapinoe from the U.S. Women's National Team.
Right,
a soccer player,
and Chris Long from the Patriots. Probably
I don't
well,
know
right?
that he ever. Well, yeah, I mean, but he didn't do. He didn't. You know, there were a couple of Patriots players who raised their fists, kind of a week or two after Kaepernick, and he wasn't there. So they have spoken out, but no one else joined in this specific national anthem protest.
And I, you know, it seems as though in the NBA in particular, the things that athletes are speaking out about are largely injustices that they feel have been done to African Americans in their communities or nationwide. I would argue that the resistance to President Trump is about President Trump's stances towards minority communities more than it is towards whether Steve Bannon should be on the National Security Committee, for example. Mm-hmm. Harry, real quick, while I have you here, is there polling around Black Lives Matter that you know off the top of your head, for example, as well, about sort of American sentiment around that? Because I'd be curious if it basically matches and dovetails with the feeling about taking a knee, for example, for the national anthem.
Sure. I mean, not surprisingly, the people who support Black Lives Matter tend to be, obviously, African Americans tend to support it in higher numbers. Democrats support it in higher numbers. So that we are seeing the general patterns that we are seeing in these questions as well. And they are the general patterns that we see in the American public as well. That is, you know, in terms of Democrats being more likely to support perhaps causes that are more liberal or more in line with racial inclusion and allowing African Americans or minorities to speak up and have their voices heard in a political manner. I think that these are all part of the same shell, you might say.
So, Reeves, as you were talking to athletes, did you get a sense for whether or not, you know, the activism is going to extend beyond race-related injustices that they're speaking out against?
I think that was a big question that sort of came up is when our groups. I mean, some people suggested to me that this year Major League Baseball, you know, Latino players, which make up something like a third of the league, might get more involved as immigration probably remains.
I think Adrian Gonzalez was it who won't stay in a Trump hotel.
Yeah, he refused, and a couple other players have been outspoken, but I think he's the main example. So you know, that's plausible. MLS players also, you know, that could become more of an issue. It's hard to say. There, Kaepernick, for instance, is in fact, you know, involved in a number of different causes. All of them kind of come back to various racial injustices. But he held this camp. He's done a couple of them now, where he gives like seminars on healthy eating and financial literacy and things like that. So I think it will expand from that. But as with any activist, you start getting involved with things that personally affect you, and then maybe you sort of go from there. But I would expect that it will largely, you know, athletes will sort of focus on one issue or another, and it's probably going to be something closely connected to something they care about.
So, Reese, as you look forward, you know, I think the framing of the piece for the magazine, at least, was that the politics wouldn't ever leave sports again, and there's been some discussion around how sports writers shouldn't, quote, just stick to sports, yeah, because sports is intertwined with politics, just as politics can sometimes be intertwined with sport, depending on how some places cover it. I'm curious, though, you know, we are at a heightened political moment, obviously with controversy and with real polarization. If we were to return, and this sounds like such a far-off dream, if we return to a point where, you know, even if people are unhappy with their political leadership, there's some thought that there's sort of a humane approach being taken, whether it be from the left or from the right, and injustices are being worked on and tried to be corrected. Is this the kind of thing that would tamp things down? As you said, that because it wasn't an activist age, as you said about the 80s and 90s, that would be, it would leave sports as well?
I think, of course, it will kind of wax and wane as things change. I think one thing that's notable is that, you know, Colin Kaepernick was not a reaction to Donald Trump. As he said, he didn't vote. He's not, I think he generally probably opposes most of what's going on, but his was more of sort of an issue-based concern. And an underlying social justice concern that, frankly, is probably not going away anytime soon. So I think there, you know, will be still involvement. And I think the other thing that has changed potentially is that I think athletes are aware of how much power they have, not just to speak out, but to actually change things. Things like, you know, getting their brands to sort of line up behind them. You know, some people suggested to me that, you know, whether or not this is the best policy to pursue, Kaepernick should demand that the 49ers, you know, that they use police officers who wear body cameras, something like that. And I think that what you may see, something like the University of Missouri players, like realizing that they control things a little bit more. So I think there will still be activism, because I think just athletes generally understand better than they did 10 or 20 years ago that they can actually make things happen.
Reese Weideman, thanks for joining Hot Takedown.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can read Reeves's piece at New York Magazine. It's called As American as Refusing to Stand for the National Anthem. We'll put a link to it on our show page at 538. Harry, thanks, I guess, to you too.
No, whatever.
Before we keep going with this week's show, let's get a word from one of Hot Takedown's sponsors. Hot Takedown is sponsored by Casper. Casper is a perfect mattress. Its two high-tech foams provide all the comfort and support that you need and keep your body at the right temperature. With over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars, it is quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress. It ships for free in a box so small you will not believe that there's a mattress inside. You can even try Casper for 100 nights risk-free. The Casper folks will come and pick up the mattress if you don't love it and refund you everything. No questions asked. Casper's got the right bounce and the right sink, and it is guaranteed to give you the best night's sleep that you have ever had. So try Casper in your home for 100 nights with free shipping and returns. Go to casper.com/takedown and use the code TAKEDOWN for $50 towards the purchase of your mattress. That's casper.com/takedown. Again, code TAKEDOWN and get $50 towards the purchase of your mattress. Casper.com. Terms and conditions apply. Claudio Ranieri, the manager of Leicester City, was sacked last week after leading Leicester City to the title of the Premier League last season, trying to get my Britishisms right, and to one spot away as of now from relegation this season. This podcast has done a lot of talking about Leicester City and not that much watching of Leicester City, so I was shocked to hear that Ranieri was fired, and so as a result, need to talk about it with someone. And since Kate had to bail for this segment and the next segment because of technological reasons, we called up our friend Michael Cayley, host of the Double Pivot podcast and a writer for ESPN FC. Michael, welcome back to Hot Takedown.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start just to catch some folks up on Leicester City, where they're at in the league this year and what has gone so wrong for them after a season that went so right.
Yeah, so they are currently sitting 15th in the league after coming in first. That means they're only three places above relegation, only 2 points above relegation. They are in the midst of a battle, say, in the Premier League, which is a little bit unusual for a defending champion.
And so it's unusual for a defending champion, but their them being champions was unusual. And so is it usual for – we were expecting, obviously, for them to regress to the mean. Was there any suggestion that this was going to be their mean, or in fact now are they underperforming in almost a similar way to the way they overperformed last season?
Yeah, you kind of have to add up a whole bunch of things. Because last year Leicester won the league and they took 81 points, which is a big number, solidly more than 2 points per game. But their goal difference was only plus 32, which is low for a league winner. And their expected goal difference, basically a sort of statistical estimate of the quality of chances they created, was only about plus 17. So a big chunk of what happened for them well was sort of that they were finishing well. They were scoring their chances at high rates, which are going to regress. Still, plus 17 is very good. It's nowhere close to a relegation level team. So they were both a good team. They were a good team that overperformed. And then the other thing you want to add in is that Leicester City were doing this on sort of a level of talent, a wage bill that is very unusual. Usually it's only teams with the most expensive wages that end up in the top. Leicester City are really the first team to break through that in England since, in this century, basically. And further to that, they had a team they played, all of their players played a lot of the same minutes. They got very fortunate with injuries. So there's a number of pieces that added up to Leicester winning the title last year, which involved a lot of good fortune. This year is kind of like everything that went right last year went wrong this year. Their goal difference does put them down at the bottom, but their expected goal difference is much more like minus five, minus six. In the range of an okay team, not a really bad one. They've had a few injury issues. They've had to rotate because they're in the Champions League. And basically their profile last year was of a good team. This year is of a not very good team. But last year that good team won the title, and this year that not very good team is in the relegation fight.
So is that because of the manager? How much – I think we've talked with your Double Pivot colleague, Mike Goodman, before about – how much managers matter, I think, than we were talking about Pep Guardiola, I think, during the first segment. But it seems to me like, they lost a couple of players. They're playing more matches than they were before. They were going to regress anyway. I'm sort of unsure of how a coach that was good enough to lead the team to a title last year, if he had an effect last year in the first place, would be bad enough to make them tank this year.
Yeah, and in particular, I think with coaches in soccer, I tend to look at not just the question of how do they matter, but how do they matter. I think it's quite clear watching games and looking at the numbers that coaches do affect the way the teams play. And Ranieri sort of developed this very peculiar style last year Leicester City took, they had very short possessions. They looked to get a shot away within like two or three pass attempts. They moved very vertically. And if you managed to break through their press, they'd just sit back and let you have possession. It was a very quick hitting counterattacking style. And this year, their profile is almost identical. There are more possessions in Leicester City matches than in anybody else's matches. Their possessions are very short. They attack very vertically. It's just they haven't been as good at it this year. So the kind of like managerial fingerprints that you would look for in terms of style of play haven't changed. It's just that the outcomes have been worse, which makes it hard for me to say that like it's the manager's fault. It seems like they are not executing the plan as well this year, and you can look at a variety of reasons for that. Certainly losing your star midfielder, it means you're not going to be getting the same kind of quality turnovers. But it's hard for me to say that like the manager did something wrong when he seems to have a team set up to play the same way.
Was Leicester's fan base hungering for this firing? It doesn't strike me as something that makes a lot of sense. Usually you throw a manager to the Sharks as chum to keep them happier. But was there sort of a bloodlust in the water?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm not deeply plugged into Leicester fandom, but my sense is that Ranieri, having done something that basically no Leicester fan like thought would ever happen in their lifetimes, is beloved, and he's also just sort of a really likable guy, a character who's always been like wherever he's been in world soccer. It's hard to make sense of it. They did come out on Monday and win against Liverpool, sort of big match in which they played the exact same style and got better results. And now people are talking about like, and now so people start talking about like they're showing more effort. It's kind of hard for me to see that in the numbers. It looks like it's basically the same Leicester team, and he sent out a team that played the same way they have under Ranieri,
and
new manager Craig Shakespeare.
And of course, the chance that the team is going to rebound is somewhat higher, because that would just be a regression to the mean that you spoke about earlier, which is that they're an okay team, not a bad one. And so we talked about this before on the show of management firings in many sports, but this just it just strikes me as rash to the nth degree.
Yep, and I think it seems quite likely that they are going to rebound, because the team is pretty good,
right.
and then you're going to get this huge rash of, then once something like that happens, people look for explanations. You start hearing things about the effort of the team, the heart of the team. You start hearing things about the manager not connecting with the players. And it's not that those things aren't possible. Those things certainly can and do happen in sport. But the simplest explanation of a perfectly reasonably talented team regressing to the mean, I wouldn't want to dismiss that.
And so what's next for Ranieri? I mean, I would think that he's going to be a prized coach to land for some other team, whether it be in the Premier League or elsewhere in Europe.
Yeah, it'll be interesting, because he's had a extensive managerial career before Leicester City, some of which went well, some of which went pretty poorly. But he's always been well liked. I would guess that he's going to pick up a job, but I kind of wonder if it's just going to be sort of a regular mid-table job somewhere where he can do a reasonably good job, not a place where people are going to expect miracles.
Okay, great. And so what's next for Leicester City then? It's just a fight to stay out of relegation and to sort of lick their wounds and start over next year from scratch?
Yeah. Yes. The big thing right now is to make sure they manage to survive. You know, dropping out of the Premier League is horrible. There was a report last year that Aston Villa lost £81 million last year. It's very, very bad when you drop out of the Premier League, and they need to do whatever they can to avoid it. Seems pretty likely they will. There are a bunch of worse teams in the Premier League. And then the problem they're going to have is figuring out how to keep their talent together. This is a problem they had last summer when they lost N'Golo Kanté. It's likely a problem they'll see this year with especially Riyad Mahrez. They're going to need to keep sort of buying young and trying to get the right players to fit their style.
Yeah, it strikes me that they're going to be remembered as this sort of blip on the radar before the rather than the ushering in of a new parity era in the Premier League.
Yep, this year has been the exact opposite of parity. There are six big teams, and they're the six richest teams, and they basically beat everyone else.
Yeah, it is. It's a different sport. Although, when you compare it to some of the baseball eras that we've been through, it's similar for us American fans who have not fully taken to soccer. Michael Caley, thanks so much for joining us, and hope to have you on again soon.
Thank you. It's great to talk.
Listeners, you can subscribe to Michael Caley's podcast, Double Pivot, in which you can hear Mike Goodman, who's often on the show as well. You can subscribe to Double Pivot in your favorite podcasting app or on iTunes. Before we keep going with this week's show, let's get a word from one of our sponsors. Hot Takedown this week is sponsored by Tommy John. That's Tommy John, not the surgery, but the revolutionary men's underwear brand that has redefined comfort for guys everywhere. Each pair is crafted from ultra-lightweight fabric for maximum breathability. The legs never ride up, and the waistband never rolls down. They've got a patented design that makes it impossible to get a wedgie. Of course, they have things other than underwear as well. Their undershirts go on like a second skin and never come untucked. And their socks are engineered to stay up all day. They do not ride down on your ankles. All of Tommy John underwear is backed by the best pair you'll ever wear, or it's free guarantee. So hurry to TommyJohn.com/takedown to experience life-changing comfort and get 20% off your first order. That's TommyJohn.com/takedown for 20% off. TommyJohn.com/takedown. Tommy John, no adjustment needed. Okay, now for our next segment, we're going to bring in one of my ESPN colleagues. That colleague is Sam Miller from ESPN.com's baseball coverage. Sam, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sam, also your first time on Hot Takedown. We're breaking a lot of champagne glasses today. So, Sam, you wrote a piece recently about, it was basically a thought experiment. It's called In a World Without Stats, Who'd Be Baseball's Best Player? Can you just sum up the thought exercise and the idea for us?
Yeah, so basically the idea was if there were no stats at all, zero, none whatsoever, what would we use as data and where would that data take us? And, you know, primarily the idea for this came from, you know, the sort of idea that, well, we hear that there are stat guys and non-stat guys, and yet we know that the non-stat guys also use stats. They just use different stats. We all use stats. We all use data. There is no world without data. And so I wanted to sort of explore what is at the kind of foundation of all of what we're looking at. What are we looking for when we look for data, and what can qualify as data in a world where none of it has numbers attached to it?
Well, right. And it, as a result, for me at least, as I was reading the piece, it helped me understand what I use data for and maybe what data isn't useful for. And so you wrote, I think at the top of the piece that this all started with a crush on Starling Marte. And so what about Marte was what drew you to him as maybe someone who stats weren't telling the whole story about?
Yeah. So Marte is an example. Before him, there was a guy named Justin Maxwell, who's even less famous, who wasn't even that good a ball player, but was sort of physically very beautiful on the baseball field. And I always remember thinking, like, yeah, it's a good thing I'm not a scout because I would take him way too high. And then you have a guy like Hunter Pence, who I am in awe that a bunch of scouts looked at him when he was, you know, 17, 18 years old, watched him play baseball and said, yep, that's the guy. He's going to be awesome because he does everything kind of physically wrong, it looks like. He throws weird. He sort of has a funky swing and he's blooper ridden. And yet he's a really good baseball player. And so, and I had some weird experience with this. My colleague at Baseball Prospectus from a few years ago, Ben Lindberg, and I ran a minor league team a couple summers ago. And we actually had to pick some players at a tryout in which there were no stats. Not only were there no stats from the tryout, but these were guys who we had no knowledge of their background at all. Like, we couldn't look them up and see what they had done anywhere. And so we found ourselves using all sorts of very strange kind of proxy data points that we were making up on the fly, like the way that they presented themselves and where they chose to, you know, go during the different exercises and what their jersey said and all these things that were maybe questionable as data. But when you have no other data, you are you sort of get creative.
Right. And so in this instance, you spoke to lots of general managers and to executives to see what their how they would go about evaluating players, much like you and Ben did when you guys were running the minor league team. In this instance, there were some ground rules, which is basically stats exist in the sense that hits happen, and you can know that someone got a hit, or know that or Statcast can tell you that someone ran fast to the wall, but you can't chronicle and log them and look at them in aggregate. And so what did you hear from the general managers and others who you talked to about how they would go about evaluating these players?
So the biggest question is actually figuring out how confident you are. And that's where I saw a big disagreement between the executives is some of them were very confident that they could still get the best player. And if you go in with the premise that you've got a good shot at landing Mike Trout, or the Mike Trout equivalent in this universe, then you sort of get, well, A, you get, you know, a little greedy, and you start focusing on the very small nuances that separate, you know, say Mike Trout from Chris Bryant or whatever. And you focus on those, you just go into it with a high degree of confidence. Whereas there are other people who thought that there would be just utter chaos, that there'd be like practically no way of knowing who you were going to get, and that you might get any one of, you know, 50 major leaguers who all look the part. Because really the difference between Mike Trout and Starling Marte, for the most part, is not physical. You know, they're both fast. Marte's probably faster. They're both good fielders. Marte's probably a better fielder. Marte has an elite arm. Trout has an average arm. But, you know, Mike Trout's a better hitter on this kind of day-in, day-out quality at bat kind of level that would be really hard to pick up on if you were watching 18 players in every game and trying to remember as much of it as you could without stats. And so the utter chaos general managers had just a very different philosophy about how they were going to narrow things down. And so they start talking about using filters like, you know, physical size, but also, like, you know, how good the team he's on is, where he's batting in the lineup. You know, could you ever pick a right fielder, for instance, in this world where right field is kind of a negative indicator? I mean, Babe Ruth was a right fielder, so you ought to pick. I mean, you know, if you had stats, you'd pick a right fielder in an exercise. But if you had to guess who's good and the team is telling you, well, this guy's a right fielder, so he's probably a pretty bad defender, maybe that just cuts him out. And so there was a lot more, I think, willingness to entertain a lot of players who might have something special about them, and also maybe a willingness to accept that you're not going to get the best player. You might be lucky to get one of the 10 best players, and what's the best process to make sure that you get one of those 10 instead of, you know, one of the 50.
It's interesting you mentioned process, because what you said about Marte and Trout made me think that here it's almost like an inverse of the old saw that it's process that matters, not outcome. Here we're basically stripping away any analysis of outcomes as a whole, as an aggregate. And so in some ways you have to look at process, and that might be a guy's swing, or it might be a guy's physical benefits. And so it's in some ways it flips the analytical approach on its head, because stripped of the tools that we use in sabermetrics and whatever else, you end up having to resort to basically leading indicators to what may be those positive outcomes later on.
Right. Okay. So, like, if I understand what you're saying, the way that we usually talk about using process instead of results is in decision making.
Right.
As an executive, you want to have a sound process for using data that is not badly distorted by context or flukes or whatever biases you might bring to it. But with this, you're looking at the process of the actual performance itself. Now it's sort of more player focused, and does he have a process that is likely to lead to good results? Instead of trying to focus on the results.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of a different treatment of process and outcome.
And in that sense, like the confident executives, the ones who thought, oh yeah, we would definitely still get the best player. These are very, very intelligent baseball minds who have seen tens of thousands of players play hundreds of thousands of games, and they are confident that they actually would be able to pick the guy, you know, the Mike Trout or the Miguel Cabrera or the player who's, you know, 10% better in a very small way by the way that they play the game, by the process of how they produce their results. So, like I talked to one who was just sort of describing what makes Trout special and what makes him different in a player performance process level. And it's things that are, you know, hard for us to pick up, like the swing path and the, you know, the sort of angles that he takes and those sorts of things. And to him, it would be pretty apparent. He is very confident. I sort of would joke with people I was asking this that the way to get me to not take your answer seriously is if the first pitcher you pick is Clayton Kershaw, because Clayton Kershaw doesn't throw nearly as hard as many other pitchers. He's not visibly special to most of us. It is in the consistency that he starts to become special. I mean, obviously he's special, but compared to somebody like Noah Syndergaard, who throws 7 miles an hour harder and is much taller and intimidating and all that, he doesn't look as special. But the confident executives were like, no, yeah, you would definitely notice Clayton Kershaw. Like, there is a process to the way that he gets out that if you've been watching the game for long enough and you've been trained the way that these players have been trained, you actually do see it pretty easily. I don't know if they convinced me or not, and ultimately I couldn't help but notice that, you know, most of the industry did miss on Mike Trout when they didn't have stats to go with him when he was in high school and everybody was scouting him and he was a good draft prospect but not an elite draft prospect. 23 other teams picked somebody instead of him, and, you know, within a year Trout was the best prospect in baseball. So they had a chance to prove it and they didn't. I don't know that that means that they're wrong, but it would have gone a long way toward proving that they were right if they'd gotten this right the first time.
So Sam, you know, you are a statsy guy. You for a long time had a stats podcast about a baseball stats podcast every day called Effectively Wild that is sort of, you know, was a paragon of sabermetric thinking. You ran Baseball Prospectus. You are someone who's steeped in sabermetrics. Did this exercise change your relationship to stats and how you'll use them to evaluate players in your writing or your thinking going forward? Or was it just sort of a fun side project and it didn't change you to in the way you'll approach things?
That's a good question. I think that I went into it with it only intending to be a fun side project. So I don't know that I was necessarily keen to the way that it was affecting my brain as I was going through this process. I think that I don't know. It probably didn't change. Probably didn't change my mind that much. I mean, I still think that that to the degree that what makes these guys special is mostly invisible to most of us, I still think that is fairly true, and that's why. That's why even though all of us, you know, stat head types watch a ton of baseball and love to watch baseball and pick up things here and there, it is why stats are so appealing to us and why we don't find the numbers and the pages of stats to be burdensome or boring, but to be really enlightening. I think that if I were one of these execs who can see the game at another level, or at least who believes they can see the game at another level, it would be a very different sport for me to observe. But the fact is that most of us don't have that training. Most of us, no matter how much baseball we've seen, haven't gone through, you know, 15 years in a player development system that has trained us to watch the game this way. So for most of us, we have what we have, which is a very careful, detailed record of everything that happened and our most important role in understanding the game.
All right, Sam Miller, thanks very much. Listeners, you can read Sam's work on ESPN.com in their baseball section. Sam, thanks so much for joining.
Anytime.
Before we keep going with this week's show, let's get a word not from one of our sponsors, but instead I want to say something quick about this initiative that Hot Takedown and all of 538's podcasts are part of. It's called Tripod. It is basically self-explanatory in that name. It's a month-long effort by a lot of podcasts, probably some of the podcasts that you listen to outside of this one, and it's an effort to try and get people to tell other people about podcasts. So all this month, we're going to talk to you about trying to tell a friend about a podcast that they're going to love. It doesn't have to be a friend. It can be your mom. It could be anyone you care about. It's just trying to up the podcast ecosystem and try and tell people who maybe not be podcasting at all that podcasts are out there waiting for you. Waiting for them, rather, and or also sort of trying to up the listenerships of podcasts that you love. Importantly, it does not have to be Hot Takedown. So all you have to do is turn to someone you love or, you know, someone you hate. If you think their life can get better, maybe by listening to a podcast, recommend it. See if you can bring a little more love, a little more light into the world. So in the coming weeks, Kate, Neil, and I are going to talk to you about some of our favorite podcasts. But for now, just think of this as a little nudge. We're going to keep nudging week after week. And that nudge should be towards telling someone about a podcast that they may not have listened to. And tell us what you're telling people about. Go on Twitter. Go on Facebook. Talk to 538. Talk to me, Neil and Kate, with the hashtag TryPod. TryPod. And thanks for spreading the word. Okay, now on to our significant digit. Kate is back for the significant digit. Kate, welcome back to the show.
Kate, it's good to be here.
I'm bringing the significant digit this week. And that, which is a telling number, of course, from the world of sports. That significant digit is 3,397. That is the number of career points that Washington senior Kelsey Plum has scored in her career for the Washington Huskies. She broke the all-time NCAA Division I women's record in over her career. Kate, This seems like just like a crazy amount of points to pour in over a career to me.
Yeah, number one, it sounds exactly like a significant digit I would bring. So I applaud you. And okay, so and also we could have even gone the way of just saying the sig dig was 57 because that was the number of points that Plum Kelsey scored in one game to break the record. So I think she needs something like 54 points going into that game and scores 57 to break Jackie Stiles' record. I think even the ESPNW, because I write for them, as some listeners might know, even our like weekly note we send around ESPNW, we must have had a story ready saying Kelsey Plum, you know, had, you know, whatever it was, 80 points needed entering the weekend, and we'll check in with her, you know, on Saturday and Sunday. Meanwhile, she'd like already busted through the record with 57 points, but like we hadn't even updated our news assignments yet. That's how magnificent this performance was. And like I grew up, I remember watching Jackie Stiles break the previous record and being amazed at her game. And Kelsey Plum's is in the same way because even the most amazing college players sometimes score like 1,800 points, 2,000 points. And for Kelsey Plum, she's just been putting up numbers like this since her freshman year.
Do you happen to know if Plum is likely to be number one draft pick for the WNBA next year or this year?
I don't know if she'll be the number one pick because I think oftentimes it'll be like, just like in the NBA, sometimes the draft stock of someone with like upside with like certain athleticism and height ends up being, you know, higher. I mean, she's definitely gonna be like a top five pick, but I'm sure there's going to be some concerns like her game is perfect for the college level, but is her game perfect when you up the speed and the athleticism at the WNBA level?
Got it. Cool. Well, we'll check back in when the WNBA draft happens later. All right, Kate, thanks for doing the show with me and just little old me. Appreciate that.
Yeah, I know. I'm here at high altitude and I'm still trying to bring the heat for you, Chad.
The heat travels faster in that thin air.
I know.
Thanks to Neil Payne and Absentia. It's here in my notes. Neil, we'll see you Friday at our Sloan Live show. Look forward to it. Our podcast producer is Katie Ferguson. Our podcast Flatiron is Jody Avergan. Our intern is Kara Chin. We got production assistance from Tony Chow and Jorge Estrada. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. You can find us on your favorite podcasting app and in iTunes, of course, as well. Subscribe at itunes.com/538. While you're there, be sure to review and or rate the show. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.